Because you were such an encouragement.
Okay.
I wanted to bring that down. You got it for us.
Good afternoon, everyone. Today is March 31st, 2015. This is the Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development. I'll go ahead and call us to order this time and this place. We are gathered here today to hold a public hearing on House Bill 5012. I'll go ahead and gavel that in. And today, joining us, I think for the first time?
Yes, this is the first time this session.
This session, Mr. Stainer will be working with us on this particular budget. Would you like to give us a quick overview of what we're looking at for the next few days?
Certainly. Kosher Gomberg, members of the subcommittee. The public hearing for House Bill 5012, I'll get this correct.
Yeah. 5012.
5012 is the budget bill for the Department of Consumer and Business Services. For the next 3 days, we're going to be having presentation from the agency. First of all, today for agency overview, workers' compensation system, and the OSHA program. Tomorrow, the insurance division, the finance and corporate securities division, and building codes divisions. And then on the third day, Friday, we'll be hearing from about the health insurance marketplace. We'll be getting a presentation from the Department of Administrative Services, as well as taking public testimony. The Department of Consumer and Business Services, their budget, there was no significant issues at the current service level. There's a few little technical changes, but no real conflict there. The governor's budget seeks to add about 15 positions to the agency. At the current service level, there's the agency's budget is nearly flat, less than a little over 0.5% increase. Two issues that I did want to bring up as we get into the presentation. DCBS did complete an agency-wide permanent finance plan change that established 5 new positions and upwardly reclassified 6 positions. The funding for that change was made with their existing budget authority, so there was no change in that. In fact, there was a savings of about $31,000 in the current biennium. Those positions will roll up, and there'll be a different cost structure in the 15-17 biennium. Also, the 13-15 budget, the subcommittee included a budget note asking the agency to report to the Joint Ways and Means Committee about transparency and health insurance rate review. That report was received on December 1st, and it also included information about House Bill 3458 that established the Oregon Supplemental Reinsurance Program. So in your materials, I've included the report that was given to the Joint Ways and Means on those two issues and the supplemental report that was done by Georgetown University for the agency. But without any further...
Colleagues, any questions about the roadmap? Director Allen. Welcome, and I apologize that you've joined us in the period during session where a lot of people are called away on other business, so we've got a lot of excused absences up here, but I think the weighty core of the committee is here and anxious to hear what you have to say. So if you'd like to introduce yourself and show us where you'd like to go.
Thank you very much, Chair Gomberg, members of the committee. My name is Patrick Allen. I'm the director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, the state's largest consumer protection and business regulatory agency. Delighted to spend the next 3 days with you talking about how the agency is organized and does its work to protect consumers and workers while supporting a positive business climate in the state. Mr. Stainer went through the schedule that we're going to cover, so I won't spend much time on that other than to draw particular attention to the fact that as we talk about the governor's recommended budget, issues related to the inclusion of the health insurance marketplace in the agency are decisions that you all collectively made after the submission of that budget, and so really that'll essentially be an appendix to the financial discussions we have about the agency budget, and we'll spend time on that on the third day, Thursday. As I said, our mission is to protect and serve Oregon's consumers and workers while supporting a positive business climate in the state. We try to identify a number of agency values, and what I want to do rather than go through that whole list of values is really talk about the first and the last, a commitment to serving and protecting the public and supporting a positive business climate. We really look at those as two very much co-equal halves of the agency's mission, and they together animate the work that we do as opposed to sort sort of having a primary mission with the business climate issue being a qualifier. What I mean by that is we think vigorous competitive marketplaces for the financial and other services that we regulate for the business climate in the state is itself a powerful consumer protection tool. The most valuable way a consumer can protect themselves is by taking their business from one entity to another if their needs are not being met. And so we think when we regulate, we need to be able to keep an eye toward those issues of how competitive are our marketplaces and are we providing that meaningful choice of products and services. So, for example, 2 years ago, the American Medical Association found that Oregon has, at that time, had the most competitive individual health insurance market in the country. Not surprisingly, if you look at health insurance rates as they rolled out over the past 2 years, we also have some of the lowest individual health insurance rates in the country. And we don't think those two things are accidental or coincidence. We think it's because of that vigorous competitive marketplace that we're able to see those kinds of results. So let me talk a little bit about what we do. Budgets, by their nature, tend to dwell on organizational charts and categories of funding, but I'd like to step back from that for a minute and try to talk about what the agency does really at the highest macro level. What are the functions that we do, regardless of what particular silo in our budget or in our structure they fall into? And you can really look at our work in terms of three main categories: licensing, setting standards, and education. And I'd like to talk about each of those in turn. Licensing as a broad term that means a whole lot of things, and there are different phrases that it goes by: chartering, licensing, certification. In essence, what it is authority that you have granted us to give somebody or some sort of an organization permission to go engage in a particular kind of business. And so it could be the ability to grant a bank a charter, or to license a plumber to go do plumbing work, or issue a securities dealer's license to be able to engage in selling securities or insurance products for insurance agents. In any case, what it comes typically with is some sort of an upfront description of qualifications, a set of practices that have to be followed to stay within the bounds of the license, often some kind of continuing education requirement, and the ability by us to then enforce the terms of that license. And there are a couple of things that are important in that context. In virtually all of our programs, you've given us the authority to issue civil penalties of one sort or another. Usually those are monetary. But you also give us the ability to suspend or revoke a license. And that really is an important, probably the more important regulatory tool, is the ability to continue to do that sort of business. The second area is setting and enforcing standards. And again, this is a set of work that we do that you can view quite broadly. We set standards most obviously in places like the state building code, the standards for how electrical installations need to be wired are something that we do, plumbing standards, those kinds of things. But we also set standards for behavior for individual licensees. We set requirements for how insurance companies need to pay insurance claims, and really those sorts of standards across all of our regulatory areas. And a big piece of our work is doing some sort of checking on the implementation of those standards. So whether that's responding to a complaint, inspecting a work site as a result of a worker injury, auditing a bank or a credit union based on those standards, that really is that work of establishing standards and ensuring that they have been met. And the third broad area where we work is education and advocacy. And I'll just highlight a couple of areas here that illustrate that function. In workplace safety, a large element of our workplace safety program is consultation, not going in and doing an inspection either randomly or as a result of an injury or death at a workplace, but at the invitation of a business, consulting with them on how to improve their safety practices and procedures and how to assure that workers are protected as a part of educating the employer of how to behave. Clear over on the consumer side, Medicare counseling, the senior health insurance assistance program, is one that takes incoming calls from folks who are every year struggling through the huge array of choices that they have in dealing with Medicare insurance, Medicare supplements, all those kinds of things, and we're able to provide one-to-one assistance for those folks. So those are a couple of examples of that education and advisory element of what we do. So with that as context for how we broadly view the nature of our work, as I said, budgets tend to dwell on org charts and dedicated funds and those sorts of things. And so to orient you, this is a simplified version of our org chart. As we move through the various pieces of the agency, you'll see this graphic show up in reduced form just to kind of give you a sense of where we are on the map as we go through the agency. And what you'll see across the middle of this org chart are five primary divisions that we organize our work into. You're going to hear from those divisions, plus the Workers' Compensation Board over the next couple of days. And really, the historical thing to be aware of when you look at our statutes and how we're organized, these divisions are descendants of what were once upon a time independent agencies before DCBS was created as a single agency back in the early 90s. And so a big chunk of our work is to look at the populations that we protect and the industries that we work with, and think across these divisional lines for how we think about that work. The piece that you don't see on here, just to keep this from being cluttered, under the director's office, there are a number of functions that aren't specifically called out, but they're important, and we'll come back to them. Of course, we have an agency auditor, as we're required to, and that auditor reports directly to me, as is standard audit practice. But we've also got workers' compensation, small business advocate, and injured workers advocates. And I want to call those out as being attached to the director's office, because it's a really important relationship. They're not part of the workers' compensation division, because their role is to be ombudsman and to be advocates, and so they report directly to me. Ordinarily, what they do is day in and day out helping businesses that deal with issues around getting workers' compensation insurance or individual workers who have been injured and are trying to navigate a complex system. And I'll spend a little more time later this afternoon talking about that. But they also have an important role to identify for me things that may be problems in the system, areas where systems aren't working the way they're supposed to, or perhaps places where we need to pursue legislation. So it's important that they are able to report outside the structure of the workers' compensation division. I talked about the need to look at our work in cross-cutting fashion, and so I'd like to highlight basically a couple of areas where we do that. You're going to hear today about the worker safety system, which we view as a whole contiguous system that encompasses two divisions, the Workers' Compensation Division and Oregon OSHA, and also the Workers' Compensation Board, and we'll talk in some more detail about that. We have divisions that are focused primarily on consumer protection. So that's the Building Codes Division, dealing with construction standards and the skills and qualifications of people doing skilled construction trades work. The Insurance Division, that regulates entities in the field, as well as setting practices, standards for practices, having an impact on insurance rates. And the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, that largely regulates both depository and non-depository financial institutions and programs. And we'll come back and talk about those three divisions tomorrow. We also deal with financial safety and soundness. Some of the same entities that we're regulating, but for different purposes. Instead of regulating consumer protection standards, we're regulating to assure that they're going to be there. So this is the basic function of examining banks and credit unions, insurance companies, to make sure that they're able to pay deposits to make good on claims of their insureds. Building safety is another area that crosses organizational lines. Of course, most obviously, the Building Codes Division sets construction standards. Those are standards for when work is done to build or significantly remodel a building. But Oregon OSHA also deals with construction standard, with building safety in terms of how the building is operated, what kinds of protective installations are in place, how the building is structured to be able to keep workers safe. And so both those divisions deal in some of those areas. I'd like to talk quickly about bills that we have in the process right now. This is largely all of the agency bills. There are a couple that we have actually elected to withdraw at this point. They're not listed here, but we have a number of bills focusing on consumer protection. These are around things like buy here, pay here auto dealers. This is a place where you're able to go buy a car and they keep the paper and you make your payments all in one place. It's an area that we're concerned about consumer practices, and we have a bill over in the Senate dealing with that. We've got bills around loan servicing. healthcare legislation around things like reconnecting Oregon law to the to changes in the implementation of the Affordable Care Act. Health insurance network adequacy, I believe, is on the House floor. If it wasn't today, it's coming up shortly. The idea that when you buy an insurance policy, it's not really a very good policy if you can't find the kinds of doctors you need, or doctors in the, or other healthcare providers in the places that you need them. So we've been asked to provide a little bit of information about what drives our business, and we've got drivers in worker safety and in consumer protection. In worker safety, what we're really fundamentally trying to do is to prevent workplace injuries and deaths. And this is why when we think about the worker safety system, we really put Oregon OSHA and the Workers' Compensation Insurance Division together as a unit focusing on this from the very inception of how to prevent injuries, investigating what happens when they occur, and dealing with the aftermath in terms of getting a worker treated or getting their income supplemented if they're not able to return to work at the level that they were before. In consumer protection, really it's that cross-division focus that is our biggest driver, trying to get people out of the silos of thinking about the individual programs that they operate and think about the populations that they serve. You've given us regulatory authority in fairly narrow and thoroughly defined slices: mortgage loan programs, insurance programs, pawn brokers, and so on through over probably a dozen and a half different regulatory slices. Well, people don't live in those silos. They live as senior citizens, or students and young adults, or poor and marginally attached to the economy, those kinds of things, where in those populations they've got a variety of consumer protection issues that cross those programs. And so we really work hard to get to view those regulatory slices that you've given us as a complement of tools in a toolbox that we can use to deal with issues across those populations. We've also focused over the last several years on improving the administrative efficiency of the agency, and this isn't unique to us. It's been part of an overall effort, but we've implemented projects to improve the timeliness and reduce the cost of our procurement and travel systems. We're participating in a shared payroll service pilot project with the Department of Revenue and Department of Justice to try to drive down just the individual transactional cost of the payroll shops that we each have to get payroll done accurately and timely. And we've worked in conjunction with Department of Administrative Services on a number of enterprise-wide projects. Probably the most significant that we've been involved in is looking at how we occupy space, both as a renter of commercial space out in the marketplace and in our own facility at the Labor and Industries Building, trying to shrink our footprint and expend less resource on, if you will, desks and cubicles and air, and more on programs that meet the needs of Oregonians. We've been asked to address our implementation of House Bill 4131 from the 2013 session. This is the requirement that agencies move toward a ratio of 11 non-supervisory staff to supervisory staff. And this just gives you something of a graphical representation of where we started in January of 2012 at 7-1 and where we are as of this past November at 11-1. And so we have come into compliance with 4131. I will say, this has resulted in change in the organization. And particularly, it has resulted in a change in the nature of what it means to be a manager in the organization. At that 7-1 ratio, people were much more likely to be technical experts who carried their own portfolio of whatever the work of their unit was, in addition to being the resident technical expert that their staff were able to go to and deal with questions. Today, our managers at that 11-1 ratio are much more likely to be supervision and management specialists who have a much broader span of control, and so they need to deal with probably, you know, from this number, 50% more of the kinds of issues that supervisors need to deal with. They're somewhat less likely to be technical experts. And so that changes the nature of the work and the relationship of supervisors to those that they supervise. All right, so financial overview, and again, the numbers that I'm about to walk through here do not include the impacts of Cover Oregon. We'll deal with those on the third day. All I'll say about Cover Oregon at this point is it is a significant undertaking for us to absorb those functions. The financial impact is not insignificant, but it's not as large as a full-blown division within the organization either. And so, in context, it's sort of a manageable financial issue in terms of its impact. We have prioritized. We've used a set of principles to prioritize services. Part of your package is our prioritized list of services. In general, what we try to do is we try to prioritize human safety and well-being over financial safety and well-being. Not saying that that they aren't both important, but when we get down to that notion of if we have to pick pursuing one objective over another, keeping people's physical well-being, livelihood intact is in fact a higher priority than financial impacts. We also try to look at impact on Oregonians, programs that serve lots of people versus programs that serve a few, and those kinds of issues. In terms of environmental factors, the economy, not surprisingly and not uniquely to us, has been the big elephant in the room over the last 8 years, really. And what you'll see in some of our financial displays is a very marked impact of 2007 to 2009. Pick your own dates for how long you think the recession has lasted, I guess. But you can see a marked impact on our budget over that time. The one thing I would add is that we have worked very hard as an agency to minimize, especially during economically challenging times, things like fee and assessment increases. We've really tried hard to hold the line, and you don't see us here very often with fee bills as a result of that. We try to do everything we can to improve efficiency and effectiveness within our programs and not come in trying to ask you to raise fees for those licenses and certifications and things that I talked about a bit ago. We are largely funded by those we regulate and their customers, and I want to point that out quickly. For instance, the insurance industry we regulate the insurance industry by an assessment on insurance premiums. And yeah, the company is who pays the premium, but those get built into the premium dollars that people buying insurance pay, and so we're cognizant of the fact that we're impacting the whole chain all the way back to individual consumers when we collect the revenue that we do. You have set us up to be financially a reasonably complicated agency. What you have typically done is you've given us elements of regulatory authority is you've said, here's an area that we want you to go regulate, mortgage loan servicing. Here's authority to license those people and to collect money from those people to go and do regulatory functions with respect to them, and don't use that money to regulate anybody else. So we have our 30 statutorily dedicated funds, and generally through statute about 500 dedicated fees, assessments, and charges. So it's for the dollar size that we are, that's a fairly complex structure. And so some of our administrative structure is a little bit more complex as a result of that. We have some small amount of federal funds, largely in Oregon OSHA, although those show up in our budget as other funds because they're on a reimbursement basis. We've also got an even smaller sliver of federal funds that show up in the insurance division through a variety of grants, largely having to do with rate review. And we collect approximately $144 million for the general fund through a variety of vehicles that you have created. Mostly those are in the insurance area. There are also securities, license fees, and those sorts of things, where the design of the program statutorily is for us to charge more than we need to operate programs and to have that be a net contributor to the general fund. This is the eye chart that is the summary.
Excuse me, Mr. Allen, I'm going to back up for a second and give you a chance to catch your breath.
Okay.
I think we've talked about this offline, but the fees that you collect, roughly what percentage of those are coming to the state through your credit card program?
It's a very small percentage. Most of our revenue comes from corporate transactions that are done through electronic funds transfer kinds of circumstances. The actual individual credit card fees tend to be in the licensing area, overwhelmingly in the building codes division, and the fees being paid by those credit card transactions are small, $50, $100, $200 at a whack. So there may be a fair number of them, but they don't amount to a very significant dollar amount.
And you're running those all through the treasurer's program.
Correct.
Right. Thank you. Please continue.
So as Mr. Shainer said, if you look at the bolded bottom line numbers of the percent change of the governor's budget versus the 13-15 legislatively adopted budget, this is basically a flat budget, about a 1% increase. Really, regardless of how you look at the funding area. Tracking positions to dollars, I like to call this the incredible shrinking agency chart. People's perception often is that government doesn't do anything but grow over time, and this actually it shows you our actual experience with actual positions over the period from 1999 to the proposed budget of 2015-17, and the agency has reduced in headcount significantly over that period of time. Now, to be sure, at times there have been functions that you have chosen to peel off of the department and send elsewhere. Several sessions ago, the medical insurance program that helped people who couldn't get insurance in the marketplace was taken from DCBS and sent to the health authority as an example. But in that period of 99 to 2000, 159 positions are actually just flat reductions due to workload, financial constraints, efficiencies in the organization. Mr. Shainer talked about policy option packages we have for restoration of positions, and so for scale, we're adding asking to add back 11 FTE, I think it's 14 positions overall out of, again, that 159 positions over the last 15 years that we've reduced. So we think that in the last budget period, vacancies were reduced from the agency, and we were invited to come back as the economy rebounded and as workload levels began to move upward again to ask for restoration of those, and that's largely what you what you'll see here in terms of our POPs. And I won't go into detail on this, just simply to say that we have workload POPs. You'll hear about those in the division presentations that talk about the work going on in those divisions, and then there are some POPs that are associated with specific bills where there are proposals for, we've proposed regulatory areas, and we'll deal with those in the course of consideration of those bills. So, how big is the agency budget is an interestingly complicated question, and I want to show you three slides to help help you understand how it kind of depends on exactly what you mean by that for the answer that you get. This is the largest number that you could be talking about in terms of what our agency budget is. This is our resources available for the biennium. It includes all of the revenue that we project to receive for the biennium, plus about $200 million in beginning fund balances. So those are the resources that we would expect to be able to have to spend over the biennium, except that those fund balances are either statutorily or by policy set to certain target levels. So the worker benefit fund, for example, is required by statute to have a one year of expenditure fund balance. And so it's it might be easy to say, well, gee, we have $200 million more than we really need, and not so much in terms of the buffer that those fund balances are expected to provide. And during the recession, we actually really did dive deeply into those fund balances, and they really did fulfill their intended function as a buffer. So that really gets to the next number, which is not counting those fund balances, how much do we expect to spend over the course of a biennium? And that really is generated out of current revenue. And so so another way of answering how big is our budget is about $400 million, largely made up of personal services and special payments. And special payments, in our case, are the worker benefit fund, which goes to pay insurance, workers' compensation insurance companies for the difference between benefits a worker was entitled to at the time that they were injured and how those have adjusted over time with inflation. So it helps keep worker benefits from being eroded, and is a special payment because it goes to the insurance company, which in turn cuts a check to injured workers. And then the last way of looking at how big is our budget is to carve out those special payments, the limited funds in the worker benefit fund, and really look at what our operating budget is, and that's what this number is. So in that context, our budget is about $230 million. And you can see there's really no clearly dominant component of the budget as we look across the various divisions and functions that we fulfill. I do want to say the portions of the budget that you're going to hear about today, the worker safety system, are largely the slices on the right-hand side of this pie chart, and they are paid collectively out of a single fund that's generated by an assessment on workers' compensation insurance premiums. So a tax, if you will, on those premiums that pay for the entire worker safety system, and we'll spend a little bit more time on that in a minute. like right now. The orange slice on this pie chart is that premium assessment that goes to pay for the worker safety system. The rest of what we do is paid for by a variety of assessments and fees. The most significant assessments that we have are for insurance and on banks and credit unions, where the method of paying for those functions is by taking some sort of a denominator, deposits for banks, premiums for insurance companies, for example, and applying an assessment to those to pay for those functions. The rest really then are individual transactional fees for things like permits and licenses that we talked about in context of the credit card fees. Key performance measures and outcomes. I'm going to spend just a little bit of time talking about agency-wide key performance measures and outcomes. We're actually going to embed most of the ones that are really more meaningful to the work of individual functional areas in those functional areas. So when you're talking about worker safety, you'll be able to hear the key performance measures related to worker safety and so on, because we think it's a better context that way. At the overall agency roll-up level, you'll see that 80% of our performance measures are on target, 7% are near target, and 14% are below target, and we'll talk about where those hot spots are. At the agency-wide level, the near target area, but at a long-term consistent where it's been for a long period of time, near target area is providing timely service to Oregonians. This is a measure that represents a composite of a large number of measures out of various program areas within the agency. And so we've got various parameters for how to identify what is timely and what is the timeliness success of a program to roll that up into that composite measure. We also try to measure our use of electronic transactions as an efficiency measure in the agency. What this really represents is, of those transactions that can be done electronically, what percentage are done electronically. This is a measure as much of our customers, if you will, as it is of us. Now, to be sure, we constantly work to improve the effectiveness of electronic transactions systems and the ability to do those kinds of things. But this also, over a period of time going back to 2003, really represents the willingness of those customers to conduct business online, which not surprisingly and not too differently from private industry and other government entities, has increased steadily over time. This is our required agency-wide customer service satisfaction report, and again, this is one that represents the roll-up of a large number of individual assessments of customer satisfaction. This is considered to be on target, but you can see that there is a bit of a drop in the most recent period, and we're looking at what really are the drivers of that drop. But I have to say, in context, this is things like going to a business after they've had their OSHA inspection and asking, "How do you think we did?" And still, even in that context, we score quite good satisfaction scores. Moving on, we've been asked to provide you a little bit of information about 2015-17 proposed technology projects. In context, we're not an agency that is a big generator of monstrously large technology projects. It's just not something that we generally engage in a lot of, although we have had some notably successful projects over time. There are three that are actually all reasonably small. Has to do with the Workers' Compensation Division, the Workers' Compensation web portal, and a conversion of basically some core infrastructure of what programming languages we use to do the work that we do. I want to touch on the Workers' Compensation Board web portal, though, because I think it helps illustrate why we managed to stay out of trouble on technology projects. This is a project where we had a large body of work in the Workers' Compensation Board that was essentially paper and pencil work, and we really wanted to be able to move that into a modern environment of being able to do things electronically. Rather than create a single, very large, very time-consuming, very risky project to do all of that, we approached this by creating the core backbone of the portal and successfully delivering that, and then over time adding elements that could be done electronically on that portal. The best analogy I've heard from our technology folks is we built a Christmas tree, and then we carefully constructed individual ornaments to hang on that tree. And that assured that we were able to develop the core technology and then be able to really identify for each of those ornaments or each of those functions, what is it that it needed to be able to do and how are we going to be able to get that on the tree to fit into the core structure that we had developed.
Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry, yes, Senator Johnson.
Mr. Allen, you just said something that caught my attention when you made the comment that we're not big generators of big information technology projects, and you talked about why not, and I get all that. You just had the mother of all technology fiascos dropped in your lap. There are going to have to be decisions made about that, and without a rich culture of information technology and people that speak that language fluently, do you need additional resources to help understand the pending litigation? Are there things that, because you are not technology rich, and now you have this problem?
Co-Chair Johnson, Co-Chair Gomberg, when invited by a co-chair to ask if I need more resources, it's tempting to say yes. But the reality is, when you really look at what Cover Oregon is today and what we'll be absorbing, it has stopped being a technology project and has become the operation of a program that uses technology. But it's not technology that that we are developing or implementing or, frankly, budgeted or structured to be able to go out and recreate a standalone platform. Now, that said, you touched on litigation, and very much there is an active body of work being done there. That's being done in partnership directly with the Attorney General, the Health Authority, and others. And so I feel that our resourcing to participate in that is adequate. And if we get to a place where we are going to talk about technology, and we'll come back and talk about this more on the third day when we talk about the health insurance marketplace, but for example, if we decide that we need to move forward on the small business marketplace shop, and that really needs to be a technology project, Senate Bill 1 was designed that I have to come back and have that specific conversation with you about what does that look like, how will it be built, what will it cost, how will that be funded, and have a very detailed conversation about any sort of a specific technology element. So that's a long-winded way of saying thanks, but no, I think the resource plan that we have built works, but I'm highly sensitive to the concerns you raise about our ability to manage the remnants of the technology issues that we're inheriting.
I appreciate your restraint in not taking advantage of my rather open-ended inquiry, and thank you for your answer.
Note the question and the answer.
Well, please continue, Director.
Yeah, co-chairs, that concludes my overall agency overview. And so before I call John Schultz up to talk about worker safety, I thought I would see if there are any other questions at the agency overview level that I could answer.
Well, let me start, Director. You touched on shared administrative services, I believe you said, with revenue and justice. Could you tell us a little more about that?
Sure. Chair Gomberg, that's a pilot project that we have been engaged in to try to see each agencies across state government operate their own payroll shops. And I kind of like to think of functions like that as sort of like tadpoles in neighboring ponds out in the woods somewhere, where over a long period of time they each evolve a little bit differently. Not because there's anything particularly right or wrong about the way they evolve, but over a period of time they get to be different because each agency made a set of logical decisions to get to a place where they are. Well, that creates a bunch of differentiation in areas that are sometimes difficult to try to really get your arms around. How do they work, and how can you be more efficient? We, together with revenue and justice, under the aegis of a improving government project through the enterprise leadership team, decided to see, well, can we work on actually looking at the underlying business processes, map them out, identify what are best practices, and then do things like reduce the cost over time of delivering those functions, improve the record in terms of errors and reissues on payroll and those kinds of things, reduce overpayments and underpayments that occur in the system, and figure out how to add some standardization and uniformity to an area that really is we think ripe for it. And so our first step in that is to take our existing three payroll shops and co-locate them, which we have done as of about a month ago at the Department of Justice, where they serve the three agencies. They're implementing these best practices for how the function is done over time, and we believe, as we prove this out, we'll be able to provide a roadmap for others that want to try to achieve some of the same kinds of improvements and implementation of best practices over time.
Interesting. Thank you. Representative Nierman, you had a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Allen, so when you were talking about the 41-31 mandate and the 11-to-1 ratio of supervisors there, you said that that kind of changed your organization. You gave a little bit about that. But what I was interested in is what's your opinion of that? Was that change, was that good for your organization, or was it, has that been a negative for your organization? Or could just go ahead and just speak freely on that, if you would.
Co-chairs, Representative Nierman. It was a direction that we had not been focused on ourselves. Now, I think that's a mix of good and bad. A long time ago, I worked at U.S. Bank for a bank president who was fond of the phrase, if you measure it, it will happen. And so, adding a measurement to a function that really hadn't been examined that way, I think caused some pencil sharpening and some thinking about the organization. Looking back now, I'd say, like anything, there have been positives and negatives with that. And so it's changed the nature of management in the organization. We've gone back and invested in new kinds of training and orientation for managers that we've worked on putting them through to make sure they have the skill sets they need to do that much more focused management work. I think over time on the plus side, we'll see that management work done better. So simple things like if you're dealing with progressive discipline with an employee, you can do that well or you can do that badly. And, you know, if I get involved, usually it means something got done wrong along the way and we're trying to fix it. So the more of that you do, the better at it you get and the less likely there are to be problems. On the other hand, I talked about the fact that our managers now are less likely to be as deeply steeped in the technical expertise of the work of the units that they manage. That's not to say they don't know anything about what they're managing by any means, and often they are technical experts, but they may have been technical expert in one area where they were working with a group of five people, and now we've added six other people who are from a somewhat different area to their span of control as managers, and they're still fairly expert in the one area and not expert at all in the other area, and so it's changed that work a little bit. And so, as I say, speaking freely in front of you and everybody watching at home, I haven't tried to total up the pluses and minuses. I just want to observe that both sets are there.
Can I follow up? It's not really a follow up, just another question. So I'm also on the IT subcommittee for Ways and Means, mm-hmm. and we had the Oregon Health Authority in there the other day, and they gave a very good presentation. And I was kind of surprised because my understanding of the Cover Oregon thing was that was going to be handed to the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and that really that Oregon had to maintain, forgive me, I'm not a lawyer, kind of the veneer of having our own state exchange and in order to preserve the subsidies. And I was kind of surprised when I saw that their budget for that was $62 million. And so I remarked that seemed more like a $50,000 thing than a $62 million thing. And she went on to, and I forget the name of the person who was in charge of that or who made that presentation, but she went on to talk about how that was going to be a pretty extensive process there. So are you aware of that, that's a $62 million project coming your way there?
Chair Gomberg, Representative Nierman. Yes, that's the fiscal impact on Senate Bill 1, which is a fiscal impact that was done by us, and I'm struggling to think about how to describe this fairly simply. Once upon a time, there was an idea to have a single entity that would buy a single system to deliver both qualified health plans on the private side and Oregon health plan on the public side, and it would use one platform to do all that work. And that platform famously failed when the switch was supposed to be turned on. And the part that faced the consumer never was delivered and never worked. The part that the agency used to do the work after an application came in was delivered in an albeit rocky kind of a fashion. In response to the failure of the platform, the work was split amongst two agencies. The private insurance work stayed with Cover Oregon. The public insurance work went to the health authority. There only ever existed, though, one back-end platform, and Cover Oregon has the licenses for the back-end platform. So when you think about Cover Oregon, having a fiscal impact of $60 million. $40 million of that is money that OHA pays to Cover Oregon for its share of the licenses, for its share of the back-end platform that it uses. The remainder is actually the true cost of Cover Oregon's own operations and the licenses that it uses to manage that back-end. Even that back-end over time will go away on the Oregon Health Authority side. They're moving to the Kentucky platform, and so they'll move off that Oracle platform. And of course, in Oregon, we're using the federal technology, and so our use of that Oracle platform right now is for things like tax statements, looking up information where there are questions about when insurance was obtained, and those kinds of things. And that work will also gradually diminish over time. Does that help?
I think I'm still confused about for at least for the healthcare exchange, the exchange part of it, so not the Medicaid part of it.
Uh-huh.
None of the $62 million has to do with that, or
no? A portion of it does. $40 million of the $62 million has to do with pass through funds from the health authority. The remaining $22 million is made up largely of staff and those kinds of expenses, but there's an element of it, and I don't have the number off the top of my head, that is Cover Oregon's portion of the licenses that are necessary for Cover Oregon's use of the system.
And that's $40 million worth of basically just licenses then?
The part that passes through to OHA, licenses and services. So some of it is hosting, some of it is licenses. It's four or five elements that are being paid for that way.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
Okay. Any other questions?
If not, then I'd like to call John Schiltz to the table. To talk about the Workers' Compensation Division. Again, we're going to talk about the remainder of this afternoon, the worker safety system overall. And this is the system. We won't talk about funding division by division because this is all paid uniformly out of the what we call the premium assessment operating account. It's the assessment or tax on workers' compensation insurance premiums that we collect from insurance companies. And so with that, I'll turn it over to John.
Co-Chair Gomberg, members of the committee, I'm John Schiltz, I'm the administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division. The Workers' Compensation Division regulates and educates and audits to ensure that employers, first of all, are providing workers' compensation insurance coverage for their employees. We ensure that workers are receiving prompt and complete medical treatment, adequate reasonable income benefits while they're disabled from work, so that workers can be restored to self-sufficiency as quickly as possible. This system in Oregon is like most workers' compensation systems in that employers and workers are protected by the insurance, which is the sole and exclusive remedy for occupational diseases and injuries. Our mission at the Workers' Compensation Division is to continuously improve the Oregon workers' compensation system for employers and workers. Oregon has achieved the ninth lowest cost of any state in the United States, but I would point that the greatest achievement right now of the Oregon system is that, yes, we've lowered costs tremendously to employers, while increasing benefits to workers. You may be aware of some recent articles that were in the media. ProPublica recently conducted a study, and it was reported fairly thoroughly by National Public Radio. There was another article yesterday. The basic message in these articles about workers' compensation is that many states have lowered their costs by slashing benefits to workers. Oregon didn't do that. The ProPublica study, in fact, identified Oregon as one of the few states that has continued to increase worker benefits, and the benefits they recognized were permanent disability benefits and fatal benefits, but Oregon has increased more benefits than that. That's not to say that we don't have work to do in the Oregon workers' compensation system. Yes, we do. It's always a work in progress. Our reform era in Oregon occurred before many other states, and I think the big four reform successes are as follows. We have improved workplace safety, which has resulted in tremendously fewer injuries, and fewer catastrophic injuries. Besides, we have less permanently disabled workers because of their on-the-job injury in Oregon. We have less permanently and totally disabled workers in Oregon. We have better claims processes in Oregon, which I point to a couple of examples, our return-to-work programs, as well as we have required adjuster certification and continuing education requirements in Oregon. Better medical practices have definitely helped, especially in the area of diagnostics and physical rehabilitation for workers. And this has resulted in the affordable costs for employers and better outcomes for workers in our workers' compensation system.
Mr. Shields, I'm going to interrupt you for just a second. I mean, we've got good news that we're having fewer injuries. And would you attribute any portion of that to changes in the basic nature of industry in Oregon, particularly downturns in the forest products industry? Or to what degree would those kinds of shifts contribute to this positive news?
There has been a shift very recently because of the recession, actually, where we saw a lot of the higher hazard industries actually taking the biggest hits in terms of reductions in Oregon, not just the woods industries, but manufacturing, trucking, and construction, most specifically. However, those industries are coming back, and frankly, in Oregon, we've seen reductions in every industrial sector in terms of workplace injuries, with the exception of one, which, interestingly enough, is the medical sector, and it barely has an uptick in that one. Every other industry sector has seen reductions in the injury incident rate, the number of people injured, as well as the severity of the injuries. So it's more than just the mix of business and the mix of hazards that's driving this in Oregon.
And we've been talking about Oregon, of course. Are other states seeing similar kinds of trends, or are we doing better in general?
Co-Chair Gomberg, other states are also seeing improvements. I think that the safety, the focus on a safety culture and keeping people safe and sound is a national phenomenon. So we're seeing reductions across the nation. Oregon has a mix of what I would characterize as interrelated components to our system that are really driving the costs down I plan to cover for you.
All right. Well, let's keep going then. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for the questions. Our role is to administer, regulate, and enforce the workers' compensation law. As Pat pointed out, education and outreach underlies these activities and everything that we do. How we carry out our functions does necessarily change over time because there's changes in the environment and in the marketplace. So some areas where we are now focusing include accepting more required reports electronically. We're focusing our audits on poorer performance areas by insurers or service companies that provide the benefits for workers, and I'm going to touch more on that in a minute. We're also doing a lot of collaboration with other agencies, for example, working with the Employment Department to connect employers with our preferred workers, as well as continuing to participate in the Interagency Compliance Network to reduce payroll classification errors by employers. This slide represents the decrease in costs of Oregon's workers' compensation premiums that are paid per every $100 in payroll. In 1990, employers paid $3.27 per every $100 in payroll for workers' compensation. Today, employers are paying $1.27 per every $100 in payroll. The assessment that employers pay for our worker safety system has dropped from 16 cents for every $100 in payroll in 1990 to just over 8 cents today. And you, Co-Chair Gomberg, asked about this. There are several factors that are leading to those cost decreases. I mentioned workplace safety as a big factor. I think controlled medical cost growth in Oregon has played a big role, especially in the last decade, and our return to work programs that are very unique to Oregon are playing a very big role as well.
If I could just jump in, I do think However, when you look at this graph, it's reasonable to expect that this pattern won't continue. We have long ago harvested the low-hanging fruit in the worker safety and workers' compensation system, and so we fully expect these rates to begin to level off and not continue to see decreases the way they have. We've frankly been surprised by the decrease in rates the last couple of years, and so we wouldn't be surprised to see them level off or even small upticks back up, but still at levels that are significantly lower than they were back in 1990. I'm sorry.
The next slide demonstrates the number of disabling claims compared to two benefit categories being paid. And the two benefit categories are wage replacement benefits. One is temporary disability benefit, which if you're disabled from the job because of your injury, it's a wage replacement. The other benefit being permanent disability benefits, which if you have permanent impairment from the injury, typically you lose some earning capacity because of that permanent disability. And so we looked at these two benefits to determine how have they changed over time in Oregon. The blue line shows the number of disabling claims have gone down approximately 35% between the years of 1995 and 2013. Over those same years, the red line shows the total dollars of temporary and permanent disability payments that have been paid. And as you can see, goes up and down a bit, but they've remained relatively stable. That means even though the number of claims in the system are down by quite a bit, the disability dollars actually being paid out to workers is remaining the same, which means that individual workers are seeing their benefits go up here in Oregon.
Yes, Representative Whitson.
So when someone qualifies for workman's compensation, is it just for a limited time? It's not like Social Security disability where once they're on, they're there for the rest of their lives?
Co-Chair Gomberg, Representative Whitsett, it depends on a set of factors, but it is possible that a worker can be found to be permanently and totally disabled and receive benefits for the duration of their life. A worker who's fatally injured on the job, their beneficiaries would receive benefits over a long period of time, the spouse perhaps for the rest of her life, unless they remarry.
Follow-up?
So there's been a dramatic increase nationally in Social Security disability and in claims awarded for lifetime. It's up like six times what it was about 15 years ago. And so when you are these people also drawing or eligible for federal Social Security disability at the same time they get workman's comp? So, I mean, are they getting a double payment if they are permanently disabled or eligible for it, I should say?
Co-Chair Gomberg, Representative Whitsett, there is an offset factor for workers who are eligible for Social Security and still receiving benefits through the workers' compensation system. It's frankly a fairly rare event inside of workers' compensation. And I think the best answer I could give you is I should get back to you with a written answer on that in terms of how that works.
Okay, I just want to follow up. It seems like there per capita is an inordinate number of firemen that like Portland has a number of firemen that have gone on permanent disability. It's just what I've read. I don't know that for a fact. But and so I guess I was just wondering if you work for a state agency or for a municipality or whatever, you're also eligible for workman's comp? I mean, they pay in, is that correct? The state or city or whatever, so they all fall under that, these policemen and firemen that are disabled?
Co-Chair Gomberg, Representative Whitsett, the majority of Oregonians who are working, whether they're state employees or municipal employees or private employees, are eligible for workers' compensation benefits, and and their employers are subject as well. However, Portland Police and Fire is a separate program that is not part of the state workers' compensation program. That the legislature sometime back separated that program out, so they have a similar but different program. And if this helps as well, the numbers of permanently and totally disabled workers in the Oregon system is very low at this time. Going back 30 years, it was not unusual to see upwards of 150 workers annually being determined permanently and totally disabled in the Oregon system. It's much more the case today that that number would be under 20 and often under 15 workers found permanently and totally disabled in the Oregon system. There's an array of reasons why that would be true, but again, I would note workers are working in much safer conditions today. There's the medical services are remarkable, and return to work plays a huge role in keeping workers from drifting away from their place of employment.
Okay, I just have one last question.
How
many people would you estimate are in the Portland system that, and I assume that is the only system that is outside of Oregon's workers' comp system. I was just wondering if you could tell me how many total are in that system that are not then paying into hours or part of, saying hours, meaning the state of Oregon.
Co-Chair Gomberg, Representative Whitsett, there would be another exception that I didn't mention before. That would be federally employed workers are under a federal workers' compensation system.
Okay.
And I do not know the number of workers that are in the Portland Police and Fire program. We could try to get that information for you.
I'd be interested. Yeah, thanks. Okay. Thank you.
Good. Please.
This slide shows the revenue that's received from the premium assessment Pat talked about a few minutes ago. The revenue pays for products and services offered by the Workers' Compensation Board, the division, the ombudsman that Pat talked about, as well as Oregon OSHA. Revenue fell sharply, of course, in the recession. The revenue is based on a percentage of the employer's insurance premiums, which are based on payroll. As payroll increases, employment rates improve. As a result, you see a correlating increase in revenue, and that's the situation that we're in today. In fiscal year 2014, the revenue was over $60 million. As employment increases in Oregon, the workers' compensation system typically experiences growth in disabling claims. Because of that, we are asking for an additional FTE through a policy option package. In 2009 and 2010, as Pat already covered, agency staff was greatly reduced. The vacant positions that were reduced were abolished in 2011. Our caseloads are now increasing as employers hire more workers. When reviewing disability benefit disputes and awards, we have very short statutory deadlines upon which to act. When a physician examination is required as part of that process, we need to be able to schedule those very quickly. And so we're looking to add a public service representative for position to allow us to continue to meet the statutory deadlines of this program. That position would be funded through DCBS's funds, the premium assessment operating account.
Another question?
Yeah. On your workman's comp, do you recognize stress, anxiety, or psychological disorders in your disability?
Co-Chair Gomberg, Representative Whitsett, if the injury that arises out of the course and scope of employment produces conditions such as anxiety or depression or any other psychological condition, it's possible that that could be part of the compensable workers' compensation claim. However, stress in and of itself has a very high standard of proof under the Oregon workers' compensation law, and it's not a typical condition that we see a lot of.
Thank you.
I've shared some of the achievements of the system with you, but every 2 years we report out on specific key measures for your consideration, and the legislature has provided us with a great ability to look at data, which is very helpful to us in making database decisions. So I wanted to talk about some of our KPMs. First is timely worker benefits. This slide shows that workers are getting their benefits on time 90% of the time. This actually is excellent when compared to other states through studies that have been conducted by independent researchers. The next one is about accurate worker benefits. And this slide shows the accuracy of insurance company or service company benefit payments to workers. And it shows that it's been dropping in recent history. However, this drop really is due to a change in what and how we measure. Insurance companies, service companies, self-insured employers did poorly in a comprehensive audit that we conducted in regard to accuracy of certain benefits. So we chose to focus in on those benefits in terms of our audits, and you're seeing those results. They're still in what we think is a turnaround phase. We chose to focus on temporary disability benefits, which is wage replacement when the worker's disabled from his job, in which, as I noted, the industry was not performing well. And our goal with this new approach is really to improve the industry's performance in this overall. We think in 3 to 4 years we're going to have enough data to identify whether our plan is working. We believe that if we were to audit a random sampling today using our old methodology, the performance would be at or above the targets we were getting in the past. The next slide is about whether our return to work programs provide better outcomes for workers who use those programs versus those who don't. The data shows that our programs deliver better reemployment outcomes for workers. The dip you see towards the right-hand side of the chart is the impact of the most recent recession and unemployment rate in Oregon. This measure is actually a snapshot done over 3 years after the worker's injured. So there's a lag built into this. The next slide shows wage recovery and how well our return to work programs are delivering higher wages for workers who use those programs versus workers who don't use those programs. Our workers using our return to work programs are earning about 13 percentage points higher wages than those who don't use the benefits. So let me give you an example to illustrate that. Workers who don't use our programs, let's say, would be earning $10 per hour, as compared to workers who do use our programs, would be earning $11.30 per hour. And that's the difference in the 13 percentage points. This slide is a measure like golf. The lower the score, the better. What we're measuring here is the compliance with our requirement to provide workers' compensation coverage. Our goal is to determine whether Oregon employers provide that coverage for their employees. What this slide shows is the percentage of disabling claims filed against employers without workers' compensation insurance per every 1,000 disabling claims that are filed in the system. When you consider this measure over time, it's actually quite a stable measure and demonstrates that Oregon employers are doing a very good job complying with the law and providing workers' compensation coverage.
If I could just take that opportunity to observe, because this comes up in casework that you'll often receive from employers in your districts, if an employee files a claim for an injury and the employer did not have workers' compensation insurance, among other penalties, they have to pay whatever the costs were of dealing with the injury, so hospital bills, rehabilitation, they're on the hook for it all. there are times where these folks will show up on your phone or in your mail with some hideously large dollar amount that they're that we're trying to collect from them, $50,000 or $100,000 or $200,000, and often that's what is going on there. And the idea of this is to basically create there to be a strong penalty for trying to be a free rider, not let you go without coverage and push your costs off onto the rest of employers. So there's a strong requirement to pay those funds back, and we've got actually statutorily fairly limited ability to make that go away if someone is dealing with that circumstance. Sorry, John.
Thank you. The next slide shows workers' compensation insurer performance in a handful of standards. This shows whether insurance companies and self-insured employers are meeting pretty strict performance standards on timeliness of benefit payments and required information reporting. We continue to score in the low 80s, which means that over 80% of our insurers and self-insured employers are performing at 90% or higher for each of the areas that we are measuring here. And again, we're measuring a variety of timeliness and insurer reporting standards. So this is a way to look at the performance of insurers, service companies, and self-insured employers relative to a group of measures in order to hit a passing grade in any one area. They have to score at least a 90% compliance rate.
That concludes our discussion of the Workers' Compensation Division. Before we turn to worker safety, I thought we'd stop and see if there are any other questions we can answer about workers' comp.
And how do you think we're doing on time today? We've got about 10 minutes left on our schedule. Are you going to be able to jump in a meaningful way? Do you want to hold over till tomorrow?
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't realize that we were stopping at that point. So it would probably be better to go ahead and hold over.
All right. And is that going to mess up our schedule for tomorrow?
No, we'll make it work.
All right. And you had mentioned briefly the small business advocate position. Is that something you're going to touch on mm-hmm. in the next set of presentations?
Actually, I can do that in the 10 minutes we have left, if you'd like.
Let me. Excellent.
So the Mahoney Hall reforms that substantially changed the workers' compensation system in the 1990s created as an integral part of that system two different ombudsman functions that exist today in the organization. We have a small business ombudsman function that serves really two primary objectives. One is to assist small businesses that are dealing with issues about how to obtain workers' compensation insurance, how to implement effective safety programs, all the things that go with being a small employer, perhaps being at the early stages of venturing into having employees and dealing with these kinds of issues around workers' comp. Also, they help businesses navigate the process of being audited, and those audits deal with a variety of issues. The most common, though, is the classification of their employees. Workers' compensation insurer will classify your employees into different kinds of work, and your premiums will vary depending on that work. And over time, we have experience with employers mistakenly misclassifying employees or having strong differences of opinion with the classification entities about the nature of that work. There's an appeals process available for that, and we help employers navigate that to try to make sure that their workers are properly classified. Similarly, there is an ombudsman for injured workers. This is a much larger function in the agency. The small business ombudsman is basically two people. The office of or the ombudsman for injured workers is about eight staff who basically field calls from injured workers who are trying to navigate the system of how they access their benefits. They don't provide legal advice. We don't have attorneys in these functions, but they're able to answer basic questions about the forms they need to come. Complete the questions they need to ask if they're disputing something, the process they need to follow to do that. You can see over on the left-hand side, the small business ombudsman has about 2,500 contacts in a year. The Office for Injured Workers Ombudsman for Injured Workers is more like about 8,000 calls that they field to try to deal with those kinds of issues. And I think I touched on those basic issues. So with that,
I have a couple of questions for you. First of all, I mean, we've heard presentations from Boley, and they've mentioned that they have a small business assistance office. We're certainly aware of the Secretary of State's office and their Office of Small Business Advocacy. I'm a small business guy. I think we can use all the help we can get wherever we can find it. But talk to me about the potential for redundancy with the various agencies that are offering these kind of services.
Sure. So my very first job in state government was managing small business programs at what was then the Economic Development Department, now Business Oregon. And that goes back 20 years, and we've been talking about this issue over that entire 20-year period of time. The simplest answer is you've told us we need to have these functions, and so we do. From a practical standpoint, when you have an ombudsman function, there's a tension between efficiency and consolidating them and potentially getting more bang for the buck for the investment on the one hand, and on the other, distance from the area that they're supposed to be an ombudsman for. So right now I have a small business ombudsman who does nothing but workers' comp issues. He's based with our staff and is close to that work. Certainly possible to consolidate that with ombudsman at various agencies that have them. You ticked off a few. There are several more. I think what you would lose in that if you chose to do that is that closeness and familiarity working day in and day out with the people dealing in that subject matter area. So far, historically, you've ultimately each time collectively you've taken a run at that issue to leave things in favor of the status quo with the closeness to that function. But that's the inherent trade-off of efficiency for distance.
And I'm a small business owner, and I look at my workers' comp bill and say, holy cow, that's just crazy. How do I know that there's an ombudsman someplace that I can go and talk to about that?
Good question. John, are you able to tackle that? What I'm not sure
and,
about.
And
is
I'm
what,
not trying to suggest that my workers' comp bill is crazy. I'm just using that as an example.
Yeah, no. But what I'm not sure of is whether there's anything that we mandate in terms of bills or notifications or statements that would call that out. John, do you know that off the top?
I don't. Chair Gomberg, we do provide informational bulletins and those sorts of things. What I'm trying to remember is when you get your policy from the insurer or when you get your notice of compliance from the department, whether or not that information is included in that. I think it is, but I would like to make sure of that.
We'll check.
Feel free to get back to us on that.
Okay.
I'm just interested in how you promote the availability of that good service.
Yep.
Rep. Whitson.
I was wondering if you've seen or have any sense of an increase in contract labor, which I assume does not require workman's compensation. If someone comes to work for you or does a contract job for you, is that correct? They don't have to have, you don't have to carry workman's comp on them?
Chair Gomberg, Representative Whitsitt, if in the case of an independent contractor who's a sole proprietor, in most cases, if that's the relationship, then no, you don't have to carry workers' compensation for them. There are situations where independent contractors, sole proprietors, have to carry workers' compensation on themselves if they're doing commercial construction work, for example, whereas residential, that's not the case. If somebody is just coming in and doing casual labor for a homeowner or something like that, under $500 worth is what the statute specifies, then no workers' compensation insurance is required on that person. At any time that you're looking at a contractor to come in and do work, it's a good idea to have that conversation with the contractor, as well as whether or not they are licensed through the CCB, which recommends the same thing, and the CCB would tell you the same thing, is to ask about their workers' compensation status. Do they carry it on themselves?
Follow up?
You see a lot of landscaping, especially around Salem, landscaping groups that they don't have a CCB number on their trucks or their trailers or whatever. And I was just wondering, does anybody check on them, or, you know, how is that handled? Because, I mean, I have the feeling there are a lot of people working outside of the system that are in some fairly hazardous handling equipment and doing things that they could be injured while they're doing. And I was just wondering what kind of a system you have for checking on those.
Chair Gomberg, Representative Whitsett, actually there's quite a bit of work does go into that and in a variety of agencies, because there is an underground economy out there, and there are people who are working without the required licenses or required workers' compensation insurance. So in that situation where you have somebody who actually has a crew, or even if it's just one person who is working for somebody who's offering landscape services, that person qualifies as an employer under Oregon law, and that worker qualifies as a subject worker for workers' compensation purposes, as well as unemployment insurance, as well as having responsibilities to the Department of Revenue. We have a staff that tracks employers in regard to their workers' compensation coverage on a daily basis. Both field as well as in-office investigators who are tracking this sort of thing. We take tips, of course, from the public, but we also are we get identifications of potential from other agencies. So, for example, if somebody's paying unemployment insurance but not workers' compensation, they don't have workers' compensation coverage, that's a big red flag for us. And then there's the work of the Interagency Compliance Network, where the major regulatory agencies are working together to identify those types of situations and trying to intervene in that.
Just to be clear, though, if I could, the exact industry that you raised, landscape maintenance contractors, aren't licensed. And so it's as long as you're not trimming high up in trees or doing construction and design and those kinds of things, if you're cutting grass and trimming hedges, that's work that you can do without getting a CCB license or those or any other sort of a license.
But if you were to employ someone doing that and they were injured on your property, and they didn't have workman's comp covering them, are you, as the property owner, or, you know, all the people out there, are they responsible then if someone is injured who doesn't have that and they're working on their property as a contractor?
Chair Gomberg, Representative Whitsett, the facts of the situation would determine that outcome, but it would be very rare. And I can't even remember a case where a homeowner was found to be a non-complying employer where, and I'm not saying that it hasn't happened or couldn't happen, but if I was operating as a landscape contractor and I hired somebody to come in and work for me and they got hurt on your premises, I would be responsible as the non-complying employer to have to pay for the cost of that claim, as well as civil penalties and cost of administering the claim.
Thank you.
Last question for you. Just in perusing your webpage, Director, I noted a headline talking about group funding for small business, and I just wondered what the connection was there for the agency.
Chair Gomberg, the bill that was passed in the last full session, I believe, dealt with that kind of funding as a part of securities law in the state, and so we were the ones responsible for developing the administrative rules to deal with that program. You'll hear from Division of Finance and Corporate Securities tomorrow, and David Tatman, the administrator, can be sure to touch on that.
Excellent. We'll look forward to it. And before the committee entirely evaporates, I'm going to go ahead and conclude the public hearing. And anything else we need to cover today? Then we will see you all again tomorrow.
Got
Thank
it.
You so
Thank
very
you.
Much. And we are adjourned.